It doesn't help, of course, that this entropic fiasco of self-reinforcing feedback loops and diminishing returns have been labeled the American dream. Because neither patriotism nor all the Prozac in the world will immunize us from the consequences of our own behavior, our foolish choices, and our self-destructive beliefs. This particular American dream more and more looks suspiciously like a previous investment trap. We've sunk so much of our national wealth into a particular way of doing things that we're psychologically compelled to defend it, even if it drives us crazy and kills us. It was interesting to note over in England how many people were out enjoying themselves in the public realm with other people. By public realm, I mean in the streets, the cafes, the pubs, the parks, the riverside promenades, and other places explicitly designed for humans to enact their hardwired social proclivities. Everywhere I went in Oxford, Cambridge, and London, I was amazed at the hordes of young people so obviously enjoying the company of groups of their friends. And what a contrast this was to the current culture back home, where you hardly ever see anything but a couple, or perhaps two couples, out in a bar or restaurant, and where the Starbucks cafes are filled with solitary individuals, and the streets are for cars only, usually with lone occupants. It was also startling in England to see groups of old people walking together in the streets or sitting on a blanket in the park, because in America old people have been conditioned to go about outside of home only in cars. Today's older Americans have spent their entire lives in a car-obsessed culture, in which walking is seen as uncomfortable at least, and at worst socially stigmatizing, something only winos do. In Europe, people make 33% of their trips by foot or bicycle, compared with 9.4% for Americans. American suburbanites weigh an average 6 pounds more than their counterparts in walkable cities. They have higher blood pressure, are more susceptible to diabetes, and live 2 years fewer on average than Europeans. Statistics hardly tell the whole story, though. The emotional toll of the American dream is steep. What we see all over our nation is a situational loneliness of the most extreme kind, and it is sometimes only recognizable in contrast to the ways that people behave in other countries. Any culture, after all, is an immense environment, and I suspect that most Americans are unaware of how socially isolated they are among the strip malls and the gated apartment complexes. Or, to put it another way, of what an effort it takes to put themselves in the company of other people. This pervasive situational loneliness of being stuck alone in your car, alone in your work cubicle, alone in your apartment, alone at the supermarket, alone at the video rental shop, because that's how American daily life has come to be organized, is the injury to which the insult of living in degrading, ugly, frightening, and monotonous surroundings is added. Is it any wonder that Americans resort to the few things available that afford even a semblance of contentment? Eating easily obtainable and cheap junk food, and popping a daily dose of Paxil or Prozac to stave off feelings of despair that might actually be a predictable response to settings and circumstances of our lives? I'd add pornography to the list also. A substitute for sex with other real people who cannot be accessed in the condition of pervasive situational loneliness. How depressing. If it's any consolation, I repeat what I have said in this space in previous rants, that we are headed into a social and economic maelstrom so severe as the people on this earth contest over the remaining oil and gas supplies, that everything about contemporary life in America will have to be rearranged, reorganized, reformed, and rescaled. The infrastructure of suburbia just won't work without utterly dependable supplies of reliably cheap oil and natural gas. No combination of alternative fuels or energy systems will permit us to run what we are currently running, or even close to it. The vaunted hydrogen economy is, at this stage, a complete fantasy. And at the very least, there is going to be an interlude of severe disorder and economic discontinuity between the unwinding of the cheap oil age and everything that might plausibly follow it. We will be driving a lot less than we do now, and cars will generally be a diminished presence in our lives. The automakers and the oil companies can lobby all they like, but history has a velocity of its own, and it is taking us into uncharted territory where the GM Yukons and Ford excursions will be useless. When the suburbs tank, they will go down hard and fast. The loss of hallucinated wealth is going to shock us to our socks, and the fight over the table scraps of the 20th century is liable to entail a lot of political mischief here in the USA. The physical arrangements for daily living will have to be revised and reordered accordingly. We're going to have to return to traditional human habitats, towns, villages, cities, and agricultural landscapes. We will have to walk out of necessity, or at least ride some places with other people. We may be too busy to indulge in the blandishments of television and the other entertainment narcotics we become addicted to. And even the internet may be made irrelevant in a world of regular brownouts. We may have to grow more of our food closer to home and do some of the physical work ourselves. As far as I know, there is no such thing as a cheese doodle bush. We are going to be living a lot more locally and thrown on our own resources. We're going to have to do this whether we like it or not, because circumstances will compel us to. There may be a lot of hardship and difficulty, but in the process, we are going to get some things back that we threw away in our foolish attempt to become a drive-in civilization. And most of these things we will get back have more to do with living on more intimate terms with other people, getting more regular exercise, eating better food, leading more purposeful lives, and rediscovering the public realm that is the dwelling place of our collective spirit. Paradoxically, when that happens, fewer of us will need Prozac or the Atkins diet. And I've been reading from Big and Blue in the USA by James Howard Kunstler from Orion Magazine Online. James Howard Kunstler is the author of The Geography of Nowhere and Home from Nowhere. His newest book is The City in Mind, Notes on the Urban Condition. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz.
See the man in his limousine, in his tie and well-pressed shirt, hoping that he's not been seen on the lookout for dessert. He knows that he is guilty, and a visit might be paid by the vegan vigilantes of the biotic making brigade. What's that sailing through the air in the boardroom? See them shiver. You can spend your life hoping for pie in the sky, but the baking brigade delivers.
There's the chorus.
If you sell your city soul to the landlord's greedy pack, you, my friend, have earned yourself a tasty pastry snack. You can call yourself a liberal and hope your crimes will fade, but your sellout soul will be exposed by the biotic baking brigade. What's that sailing through the air in the boardroom? See them shiver. You can spend your life hoping for pie in the sky, but the baking brigade delivers. If you cut down the last of the forests, spew poison in the air, don't you be surprised to find that cheesecake in your hair. Yes, if you are a corporate criminal, you've surely made the grade to receive a fresh baked goodie from the Biotic Baking Brigade. Here we go.
What's that sailing through the air in the boardroom? See them shiver. You can spend your life hoping for pie in the sky, but the Baking Brigade delivers. So smile for the camera with the cream pie in your face. You can hope that we won't find you out as you're hiding in the shade. Someday soon you'll meet your doom, the Biotic Baking Brigade. Here we go. What's that sailing through the air in the boardroom? See them shiver. You can spend your life hoping for pie in the sky, but the Baking Brigade delivers.
One more time.
What's that sailing through the air in the boardroom? See them shiver. You can spend your life hoping for pie in the sky, but the Baking Brigade delivers.
David Rovics, the Biotic Baking Brigade. The Pew Initiative on Food and Biotechnology has released the results of a new survey on public sentiments about genetically engineered foods. Survey respondents seemed unaware of the extent of genetically engineered foods in the U.S. food supply. According to the survey, only 24% of Americans believe they have eaten genetically engineered foods, while 58% say they have not. Since 70-75% of all processed foods contain soy or corn that has been genetically engineered, everyone who does not maintain a strict diet of organic foods has probably eaten GMOs. Also, according to the survey, 89% of Americans agree with the statement, "Companies should be required to submit safety data to the Food and Drug Administration for review, and no genetically modified food product should be allowed on the market until the FDA determines it is safe." However, most of those surveyed appeared unaware that under the current regulations, biotech companies are not even required to notify the FDA that they are bringing a new product to market. At the same time, there is a growing movement for safe food and sustainable agriculture that is emerging from the grassroots with little to no support from the government and media cheerleading that biotech receives. Small organic farms are quietly springing up all over America, and the demand for their products is increasing at a whopping 30% yearly. Even some in corporate America have taken notice of the trend. The 7-Eleven store chain is now stocking organic chips. Price Chopper Supermarkets is releasing a line of 20 of their own organic products, including veggie burgers, chips, and soy milk. Is organic food really better? Was the title of a workshop given at the 2003 EcoFarm Conference in Asilomar, California, in January.
There are the trends in society as far as food consumption is towards more discriminating consumers. And I believe that nutrition will give us more good discriminating reasons for wanting to buy and eat organic foods. And I think from that is where we hope to organize this workshop. And that said, we have two presenters today to talk about this particular subject, and I'd like to introduce them. And first is Chuck Benbrook. Chuck Benbrook's from Idaho and a longtime researcher and involved in the dialogue about agriculture, both with the National Academy of Sciences and with numerous think tanks and universities and corporations and the government. and has been in lots of different parts of this, and I think will bring some perspective as well as what he's learned about nutrition, what's known and not known, what needs to be, etc. So first Chuck, and then Helga Hellberg from now the marketing person, I think director is the title with CCOF, but also has an interest and knowledge in what's been learned and what needs to be learned and what's not learned in organics and related to nutrition. And in addition to this whole issue related to consumption, which I think will be driven, there's also the whole relationship of the nutritive value from a medical standpoint. And that's an area I hope we broach here, because I think it's actually one that is worthy of more consideration. So without further ado, I'd like Chuck, please, to come up, and he's going to give us his presentation about this issue. Chuck Benbrook.
Thanks, amigo. It's always a pleasure to have an opportunity to come to Asilomar and visit with all my friends in California agriculture. I'm going to speak about the impact of pesticide residues on food safety and human health, and I'm going to make the case that it's time for the organic community to sort of come out of the closet and start to openly discuss the benefits to certainly some segments of our population from seeking out organic food and reducing exposures to residues through the diet. For many years, the organic community has shied away from making any overt food safety health claims because of concern about a lack of solid data and science to support those claims, recognizing that if the organic community got too far beyond the science that was available, it would trigger a well-organized, well-financed backlash like what we're seeing now against independent researchers and scientists that are working on GMO risks. But as a person that's worked in the area of food safety assessment and pesticide risk assessment for longer than I care to admit, I'm here today to tell you that the scientific case is now rock solid that purchasing and consuming organic food is a reliable way to substantially reduce pesticide risk, and that all of the toxicological evidence now suggests that for some segments of the population, this reduction in environmental risk load, if you will, is certainly needed to expand what the concept of margin of safety, which is used pretty widely in regulatory risk assessment. The job of the EPA and the California Department of Pesticide Regulation is to try to broaden that margin of safety between the level of exposure that is happening to people either through the diet, through residues in water, or farm workers from being in and around sprayed fields. We want to expand that margin of safety between a level of exposure where there's evidence that a known adverse biological outcome is probable, and the level of exposure that's actually happening. And I'm going to share with you some of the recent information that shows that it's really important to do that, particularly for pregnant women, infants, and children through about age 12. This is kind of technical, and there's a lot of numbers I'm going to throw at you. So I've written my talk up in a form of a paper. It's fully referenced. I think we all know, from following consumer surveys, that a major reason people seek out organic food is because they're concerned about pesticide residues in the diet. They're concerned about risk to their families and to themselves. Both the people that consume organic food and the general public, when they're surveyed, somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters identify concern over pesticide residues in food as a major issue. We know that the consumer is focused on this. In the summer of 1996, Congress passed the Food Quality Protection Act, a major new piece of legislation that substantially changed the scientific standard against which pesticide residues in food were judged, and directed the Environmental Protection Agency to substantially heighten the focus on the unique risk to infants, children, and pregnant women from exposure to pesticides. The passage of the Food Quality Protection Act in 1996, those of you who have been following this for a while will recall that Congress passed that act largely in response to the 1993 report issued by the National Academy of Sciences on pesticides in the diets of infants and children. In a major report that was released during Rich Rominger's watch in USDA, and in fact, Rich was quoted 2 days before the report even came out, voicing the general support and acceptance by the administration and the recommendations of the report, and pledging that the USDA was going to move forward with the, you know, everything it could do in the realm of integrated pest management, et cetera, to try to broaden these margins of safety. After the passage of this act and through the implementation since 1996, there's been an explosion of new information on both the residues that are actually in the food, their levels, the distribution, the maximums, and which parts of our population are being most heavily exposed. There's also been an explosion of research on the toxicology, the biological impacts of those exposures. There's important new information on both the exposure side of the equation and the toxicity side of the equation. I think the probably the most clear-cut evidence is on the exposure side, where we have now several large government data sets that testing pesticide residues in food, where samples that are drawn from the marketplace, from retail stores or warehouses, that if they are starting to record whether the samples are conventional or organic or grown with some other claim, like, for example, no detectable residue or pesticide-free or IPM grown. The USDA started collecting this data in the early 1990s through its pesticide data program. I was part of a team that included Brian Baker, the director of research at OMRI, my wife Karen, and Ned Groth, a senior analyst that worked for Consumers Union, and we analyzed 8 years of pesticide data program data, about 34,000 samples, if my memory serves me correctly. Basically all of their data from 1994 to 98. We did 10 years of DPR, California Department of Food and Ag data. It was almost like 100,000 samples there. Of course, mostly conventional, but a large number of organic samples. And we also had a data set that Consumers Union had developed in about 1997 or 8, which focused on four foods, where buyers for Consumers Union went into stores around the country and bought conventional IPM grown or labeled and organic foods in four or five cities, and then CU paid to have very sensitive analytical work done on them. So what we did in this journal article that was published in the peer-reviewed journal Food Additives and Contaminants, which is kind of the most prestigious journal for food safety junkies, we publish an article that documented the substantial differences between the frequency of residues in organic food compared to conventional and IPM-grown food, differences in the levels of residues, and also substantial differences in the presence of multiple residues. And in the paper, there are some tables that summarize the findings from the published article that came out in Food Additives and Contaminants, as well as some tables that Karen and I just generated a few days ago on newer data just, you know, released in the last 2 years, the last 2 years of data from DPR. And I also found some very interesting data from Great Britain. the debate about biotechnology in Europe has really set off a very intense debate about the impact of farming systems and technology on food safety and food quality. And the reliance on pesticides and pesticide risk is a huge part of that debate in Europe. To provide some raw data for that debate, the British government in 2001 started identifying a certain number of its samples and its routine residue testing as organic. We were able to get our hands on that raw data and analyze it. And actually, the comparison of the presence of residues in conventional food versus in organic food in the British data looks even better than the U.S. data in terms of how much cleaner organic is. There's about an eight to one difference in this British data set in terms of the percent of organic samples that test positive versus the conventional samples. There's a lot of sort of technical stuff that you have to get into to make these comparisons. I'll certainly be glad to share some of those details with you in the Q&A for those that want to get into it. But the basic message I want to give people: there are several hundred thousand samples now around the world being done every year, testing pesticides in food. And most of the government data sets now are identifying organic as a subset. And this database is going to get very rich in a short amount of time, and it's going to show clearly that there, you know, residues do show up occasionally in organic food. They shouldn't be there, but they show up in a few percent, or 8%, or 10%, whereas in the conventional food it would be 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 times more frequent. Plus, there multiple residues are very common in conventional food. The average apple in America has 3.4 pesticides on it, based on USDA's data, and that's clearly not the case with organic. So, pretty clear, robust message on the residue side. People who eat organic food are exposed to a much lower amount of pesticides through the diet. On the toxicity side, so the question then is, well, so what? The U.S. Department of Agriculture, in its public announcements on the organic program, has stated over and over again that organic food is no safer than conventional food. And this has been a pillar of the department's sort of public message as the National Organic Program has been unfolded. And the basis of that position that the Department of Agriculture has taken is that despite the presence of residues that are documented in these data sets, those residues do not pose any substantial or unacceptable risk. Therefore, conventional food is safe. Therefore, it doesn't matter that other food might be safer. Well, you know, I think that's getting to be an increasingly untenable position. I mean, I think we all can understand why the USDA, that's going to be part of their public message. But I think as consumers find out more about this information and learn that there are some people in our population, particularly couples of childbearing age and families that have kids growing up, where a substantially greater margin of safety is clearly warranted to reduce the chance of developmental problems down the road for these kids as they grow up. Because what the toxicological sciences have uncovered in the last decade or so is that as human beings grow up from conception through birth and then during infancy and childhood, there are innumerable, incredibly complex and periods of development where a whole lot of things have to go exactly right for that child to grow up and be fully healthy and have an immune system that works completely, to have healthy neurological development and a full chance at a healthy life. And there is reams of science now that show that remarkably low levels of exposures to a number of chemicals, including several pesticides that show up in food fairly regularly, can block the normal developmental process by disrupting the natural role of hormones in regulating development. And this whole area of science is highly controversial. We don't have all the answers. They're just developing some of the assays to really link exposure to a given chemical at a particular time to a given outcome. Because one of the realities is that, just like a farm, if you've got a sick field, it's almost never one thing, is it? It's a combination of a lot of things that have incrementally added together to make a field sick, and you can't fix a sick field by changing one management practice. You have to change a lot of things to restore health. Well, it's kind of the same way with the human organism as it develops. Probably, I want to share the results of one more study before turning over the podium to Helgi to talk about some of the nutritional stuff. This is as a pesticide science junkie, this is probably the most phenomenal study I've seen in my adult life. It's coming out in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives, which is the official journal of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. You know, it's a very highly regarded journal. It's been published in their online version as of October 31st, 2002. It hasn't shown up in the magazine. I just got my January issue and it's not in yet, but it'll probably be in either February or March. It was done by a team of researchers working at the School of Public Health at the University of Washington in Seattle. This is a team of researchers led by a guy named Richard Feinsky, who's one of the top public health toxicologists, epidemiologists in the country. They've been one of the research teams doing lots of work funded by the EPA on exposures to toxic chemicals and impacts on health. And what the team did is they took two cohorts of preschool children ages 2 to 5, and they collected detailed dietary data for 3 days from the parents, and they found a cohort of kids that consumed predominantly an organic diet. It was 75% or more of the calories were from organic sources in this cohort of kids. And then they had a cohort of kids that ate almost no organic food and ate largely a conventional diet. And then they took urine samples from these children and tested the urine for metabolites of organophosphate insecticides, which are probably without a doubt the biggest problem from the perspective of food safety in the diet today. Residues of chlorpyrifos, and the parathions and dimethylwait and malathion and acephate and the other OP insecticides. And lo and behold, they found that there was a 8.5-fold difference in the mean OP metabolite level in the urine of the kids eating the conventional diet compared to the organic diet. Now, these OPs go through your system fast. They don't last a long time. So 3 days is a legitimate period of time to make that comparison. And the last thing that they did, which, you know, is very intriguing, they used some calculations. When they find a certain level of metabolite in the urine of a kid, they can back calculate how much of the raw chemical that child consumed in the 24 hours or 48 hours before that urine sample was collected. And so they calculated what the metabolite levels said or suggested the intake levels were, and then they compared those intake levels to the levels that EPA is currently considers to be safe, you know, based on the, you know, where they're at in the process of implementing the Food Quality Protection Act. And this is their summary. Dose estimates generated from pesticide metabolite data suggest that organic diets can reduce children's exposure levels from above to below EPA's chronic reference doses, thereby shifting exposures from a range of uncertain risk to a range of negligible risk. Consumption of organic produce represents a relatively simple means for parents to reduce their children's exposure to pesticides. Now, that may not sound like a, you know, too clear cut, but for appearing in this a peer-reviewed journal of this stature, that is a ringing endorsement and a powerful statement. This unfortunately, this study has not gotten the national press attention that it should have. It got a little bit of coverage, but that may change next week. Next week, the Centers for Disease Control is releasing its second national survey of environmental toxicants in blood and urine. It's the CDC, about 5 years ago, started this program. They released the first set of results last year. They're releasing a bigger set of results this year. And it's going to have national data on these metabolites. And I'm betting that the CDC data next week will show that the levels in this study in these children will be comparable to the levels of 2 to 5 year olds all over the country. And you know, if that's correct, then I think there'll be a real opportunity to use this paper to show how easy it would be for American agriculture to take this one risk concern largely off the table. And you know, while certainly organic is part of the solution to that, a lot of the good news about this is farmers that just get off sort of your hard pesticide program and do some good IPM without going all the way to organic, they can also get rid of these residues in food. And I think that's a hopefully a message that's going to help propel the EPA to take some stronger actions under the FQPA. Thanks a lot.
That's Chuck Benbrook. Great job, Chuck, summarizing a very important, and I got some questions for you. So when we, after Helga has finished talking, we'll be opening the floor up here and urging your dialogue. So Helga, are you ready for doing your presentation? And again, marketing director for CCOF, and also with an interest and done research in nutrition in organics.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's quite amazing. I grew up in Germany on a pretty sad diet and had my annual done. I was 27 or 28. And the doctor said, you look great, but whatever you're doing, if you keep doing it, maybe 5 years, that will be it. And I was 28. I had no oxygen left in my blood. I was working out. I was living a fairly healthy lifestyle, I thought. I had no red blood cells left, you know, the normal blood profile pretty much. And that was a shock. And I switched to organic food the next day. And within 2 years, honestly, the doctor could not believe how my health improved. So I'm living proof that changing your diet has a complete direct effect on your health. So with changing the diet, there came a whole lifestyle change. I moved to the States, trying to find a healthier environment. I started to study nutrition. I'm a certified nutritionist now, and I ended up with CCOF, and now I'm here. So thank you very much for having me. It's quite exciting. I studied nutrition, and I based my final paper on two of the most comprehensive studies that are out there right now. There are a few newer ones, but the two most comprehensive ones are one from the Soil Association in England. It's called A Review of the Evidence. A great little book that you can order. I think it's like 10 pounds. And the other one is Virginia Worthington, which some of you might have reviewed already. She works on the East Coast. She's a PhD, and she works for the University of Baltimore. And she collected every study that has ever compared organic and non-organic, which ended up, I think, being over 1,200 comparisons. So, of course, there are critics, as with every study, you can argue, you know, that the study is not conclusive. There are critics that say that most of the statistical findings, or some of them, are significantly statistically insignificant, which is true. She has samples in there or studies that have fewer than 8 comparisons, and after 9, it becomes statistically significant. But it clearly shows a trend, and the trend is enough for me to confirm my gut feeling, because in the past, if we look at history of human nature, 15 years after we developed this gut feeling that DDT is toxic, we were able to prove it, and it was finally banned. So what are we trying to do here is actually just confirm our gut feeling. So follow your intuition. Don't believe what they say, if they say other things than what I'm telling you today. So, starting with an interesting statistic, this is actually a statistic that is based on governmental data. It says the last 60 years, this statistic just shows the last 30 years, all the basic minerals, calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, iron, have left U.S. soils. I will explain, or we will see later, things like selenium, not tested here, there are some areas in the U.S. where you cannot find selenium in our soil anymore, and I will correlate that to the current diseases, and it's actually quite shocking. But so just keep these numbers in mind. This is from 1992. All the ones that were tested were depleted, and it makes sense. Conventional farmers, or I should say non-organic farmers, only put back into the soil selenium, phosphorus, and potassium in synthetic forms. We know that synthetic substances, we don't know exactly what the absorption rates are, first of all. And secondly, there are billions of microorganisms in the soil that assist the soil in taking up nutrients. So if you have completely sterile soil and you only add 3 synthetic substances back into the soil, you will end up with mineral deficiency or nutrient deficiency in the soil. If it's not in the soil, we know that 16 elements are at least essential for plant health, and 23 are essential for human health. So if it's not in the soil, it's not in the plants. If it's not in the plants, it's not in our diets. It's pretty simple. So Virginia Worthington's comparison is based on pretty much every vegetable that you can buy here in California. And we are very blessed here. I mean, we all know that, but it's amazing that we have access to organic produce pretty much year-round, although some organic apples still come from New Zealand, which brings up other issues, but that's okay. And the nutrients, the main nutrients tested, again, calcium, copper, and this is what she found. Every single mineral and nutrient, every single vitamin and mineral was higher in organic based on over 1,200 comparisons on average. And some of these minerals, for example, as I said, selenium, 372%, and even vitamin C, 27%. So that means if you eat 3 apples, organic apples a day, you have 100% higher vitamin C content in your system. That means if you want to compensate that with non-organic apples, you have to eat 6, and then you end up with diarrhea because nobody can handle 6 apples. So in terms of body ratio, body weight, and food intake, which is critical in children because the food intake or nutrient intake per body weight is much more important. They take in much more food per body weight. This is extremely important to have the most nutrient-dense food you can possibly eat. So I took her studies further and said, okay, let's look at the deadly diseases in the U.S. The 5 most common or most deadly diseases in the U.S. are heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, and osteoporosis. And although, of course, I admit that, for example, heart disease is caused by a number of reasons, if you smoke or if a lack of exercise, all that, it's interesting, if you just look at the nutrient part of heart disease, 50% of all death in the U.S., caused by disease, are going back to heart disease. The most important minerals and vitamins are selenium, magnesium, and vitamin C. So in a diet or in vegetables completely depleted of selenium, it will not be in our produce, and if it's not in your diet, you will lose one essential mineral for heart health. Same is true, as I said, with vitamin C and magnesium, 29%. And these are really just the basic minerals. There are a whole variety. You know, 15 years ago, we thought that 19 elements are essential for human health. Now we know it's 23, and now scientists say this is all that we will ever find. What is this based on? We will find new things on a monthly basis. So this is really just what we know. There are millions of enzymatic reactions in the body, and we will talk about neurotoxicity later and endocrine disruption, that we don't even fully understand yet. So really just based on the minerals, it's already not sufficient. Same is true with cancer, second leading death-causing disease. 25%, that's actually a slide that's half a year old, it's 29% right now, or around 30% of all death. And it's kind of interesting, the people that deal with cancer, the non-holistic doctors, say that statistically the death rate of cancer has dropped. That's statistically, that's true. In total, that's not true, because all we do is we extend the total life. Now they can find cancer earlier in our bodies. So the total amount of lifetime of people that have cancer is longer. So statistically, deaths have dropped. But if you see total numbers, the cancer deaths have increased. We have no solution against cancer. That's the bitter truth. The most important minerals for cancer, or to prevent cancer, are selenium, again, molybdenum, which you only need in micro amounts, but if it's not in the soil, you will not have it. And molybdenum assists potassium and selenium to be absorbed in the body. So if one of these elements, and these are just five or six elements out of hundreds of thousands that are out there, are not there, you will not be able to absorb it. Interestingly enough, the numbers we saw earlier indicated that the grade of mineral depletion in the soil is about adequate, is about equivalent to the increase of organic foods, to the higher nutrient content in organic foods. So although vitamin D and A have not been tested, it is most likely the case that even those vitamins and other minerals are depleted from non-organic soils and therefore higher in organic produce. So we can do this. I only picked the five. You get the idea. I want to move on. Stroke, calcium, magnesium, potassium, and diabetes, fourth leading death-causing disease. Chromium, vanadium, and manganese, again, micro amounts, but for example, chromium, 86% higher. If you eat a fast food diet where everything is depleted anyway, and no organic produce, I have no clue how you will get any of this, how you will get any minerals. And 50% of the food budget in the U.S. goes to fast food. So it just all presents one gigantic proof of that how we've done it for 50 years does obviously not work. Osteoporosis, vitamin D. Okay, so, and there we have the USDA government giving us two dietary guidelines. One is the RDA, recommended daily allowance, for example, for vitamin C. The same government says eat five a day. Well, if you eat five servings of non-organically grown produce based on these numbers, you end up with 70 milligrams of vitamin C in your diet. You will not meet the RDA for women nor for men. How can a government give out two dietary guidelines that don't work together? I thought that's interesting. If you eat organic, you will end up with 89 milligrams of vitamin C, so you will exceed the vitamin C RDA for women, and you will nearly make the one for men. RDAs are kind of funny anyway, because they're most of them are 80 years old, and they were intended to present to prevent scurvy or diseases that we had around the turn of the century. And I'm talking about the turn of the century, 1800 to 1900, not the one 2 years ago. So it's a little outdated, maybe, but again, emphasis on organically grown produce to at least cover the bases. Chuck mentioned the pesticides. We will allow for questions, of course, later. We almost have 45 minutes or so for questions when I'm done. Neurotoxicity, endocrine system disruption. There are hundreds of thousands of chemicals in your body that steer and manipulate millions of molecular or cellular processes. So if one of these pesticides affect one hormone, and that's what endocrine system disruption is, you hear that all the time. Pesticides mimic estrogen. That's why they're called xenoestrogens, foreign estrogens. So whenever you take in a foreign estrogen, it messes up your hormone level in your body. That's endocrine system disruption. So your liver maybe gets inflamed or whatever you have, a cold, and your brain understands like cell phone noise when you don't have good reception. And it cannot send the right army, or I shouldn't use that word these days, but you know, cannot send out the right response to combat whatever kind of disease you have in your body. So that's endocrine system disruption. Carcinogenicity and immunotoxicity, we can discuss a little later. So we have pesticides, which are the things that we don't want in our food or to grow the food. Then we have mineral depletion in soils, which leaves us with completely depleted food. And then we have issues of food production when we process food. The biggest ones are, of course, antibiotics. 70% of all antibiotics produced in the U.S. go straight to livestock feed. 70. Two-thirds, over two-thirds. And you end up without antibiotic resistance, which makes antibiotics pointless when you actually really need them. So all of these, of course, are prohibited in organic production. BSE, bovine spongiform encephalitis, it's another word for mad cow disease, which, yeah, we all know. If you give grass-eating animals animal protein as their protein source, just like humans, animals that get a diet fat that has nothing to do with their natural diet or the way nature intended it, you will end up with sick and diseased animals. So, and let's clear about it, we do have mad cow disease in the U.S. too. We just call it different names. It's kind of funny. If you go to the Montana Fish and Game Department website, they warn hunters to touch the brain of deer because they have mad deer disease. It's a protein-based virus which you actually cannot kill, so all the ashes in England are kept in nuclear holding facilities because they cannot kill the protein. They tried solvents, they tried burning it. The protein is still active. We will have this maybe for a few thousand years, this virus around. So we do have mad cow disease in the U.S. We do have it in humans. It's called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. So we can give it as many names as we have species, and then maybe we don't see the link, but it's all mad cow disease, unfortunately. Nitrates are cancer-causing in higher doses. And people say, yeah, there are naturally occurring nitrates too, and there are naturally occurring pesticides in plants, which are actually helpful for the body, that it's the response of the plant to combat pests in their natural environment. We are talking about nitrates from synthetic fertilizers. 45 million tons of synthetic fertilizers are applied on crops in the U.S. alone every year. 45 million tons. So, as we saw earlier, nitrates levels in non-organic foods have been higher in every single study. GMOs, I think we know about that one. And then food additives and ingredients. And just a couple of slides about food additives. More than 3,000 are allowed in non-organic foods to prevent spoilage and to improve color, texture, flavor, and taste. Over 4 pounds per year per person in the U.S. gets ingested. The most common food additives are hydrogenated fats, trans fats, phosphoric acid, aspartame, MSG, sulfur dioxide, color, and artificial flavors. And hydrogenated fats are linked to cancer. They mess up your LDL, your blood fat, heart disease. Phosphoric acid is linked to asthma and allergic reactions. Aspartame is linked to mind and brain dysfunction to the point of seizures, actually. So is MSG, monosodium glutamate. Oh, it's actually now called the Chinese restaurant syndrome. I love that. That's pretty funny. Sulfur dioxide, allergic reactions, gastrointestinal problems, and then colors and artificial flavors, again, asthma and allergic reactions. None of which of these, of course, are allowed in organic. So I thought it's interesting. Why is this talk here today? We are comparing organic with non-organic food. So I looked up food. Material, usually of plant or animal origin, containing or consisting of essential body nutrients, such as carbs, fats, proteins, vitamins, or minerals, to maintain life and growth. And then the other one was something that nourishes, huh, or sustains in a way suggestive of physical nourishment. So I looked up nourishment. To foster and promote the development of life and growth. 3,000 food additives added to our food that is depleted to begin with does not nourish. So what we are actually comparing here is organic food to non-organic non-food. So I want us to get out of here today with our heads up and be ready for this discussion. That's why when we see advertisement, if you still have a TV, I'm sorry, but if you still have a TV tomorrow night or so when you're back, look at the advertisements, really look at it. Never once do they mention nutrition-related advantages because it is not nutrition anymore, as we just saw. It's all based on size, taste, effects, and convenience. And if they tell you otherwise, remember that it took us 15 years to get rid of this. Yeah, and it's still in us. We mentioned that there are studies where we see organic has pesticides too. First of all, there are four different classes of non-organic non-active ingredients in pesticides. The EPA classified pesticides in different levels of toxicity. And then there are active ingredients, which are completely defined under the National Organic Program. And if we like this rule or not, it is the first food-based rule that we have in the United States. So one department in the USDA actually is now finally saying exactly the opposite of what the rest of USDA has been telling us for 50 years. I think that's a huge success. And besides that, most of the pesticides that they found in these studies when they say organic contains pesticides too, these are persistent pesticides, such as DDT. And that means that we will still find them even in organic crops or in organic soil in 150 years. It only proves that we should have never started with this nightmare to begin with, and not that organic now in 2 years can heal the world. It is the thing that we need to do in order to get to a sane production system again, but it cannot eradicate everything that we did wrong in 50 years in a few years. So, thank you very much for having me.
Helga Hellberg speaking on Is Organic Food Really Better? At the 2003 EcoFarm Conference in Asilomar, California. Thanks to Frank Moore and Michael LaBosch for that recording. And thank you for listening to Unwelcome Guests. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Bye.